is Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy, the arts of attracting, acquiring, and retaining talent. Here's Kathleen.
Thanks for joining me once again for my conversation with Shally Stickrell, the father of sourcing and president at the Sourcing Institute. We've been chatting about how talent sourcing and recruiting have evolved since he started working in the industry over 25 years ago. So, Shally, let's talk a little bit about sourcers versus recruiters. You've said that sourcers are not junior recruiters and that they're experts at both research and relationship building. For folks not as familiar with the terminology as we are, is there a difference between sourcers and recruiters?
Absolutely. Absolutely a difference. And you're right. I believe that a sourcer is a specialization of recruiting. Just like in marketing, there are people who specialize in business intelligence or sales enablement or market intelligence. There's different specializations. The same thing is happening in recruiting. And they're distinct and separate functions, although sourcing is a specialization. I think it's in the best interest of someone who wants to be a great sourcer to learn the recruiting side, even though that may not be what they're passionate about. What a sourcer, or whatever you want to call it, talent scout, researcher, whatever job title you want to give it, what a sourcer is passionate about is solving puzzles. They're not about the relationship building. They can do that, and the best ones can do a little bit of both, but what they're really, really good at is solving puzzles and being very tenacious about identifying people that are basically off the beaten trail. So it's a different skill set altogether, one that requires problem solving, one that requires a little bit of technology acumen nowadays, although not when you and I started, some intuition to be able to read between the lines, a tenacity, a different kind of tenacity. Recruiters are very tenacious because of all the rejection that we handle, right? It's not personal. It's someone's not interested in the organization. So we get very tenacious that way, but sourcers are tenacious in a different way. Their tenacity is more about the not giving up. There must be a way. There has to be a way to do this. There has to be a way to find this or whatever. So I would say that sourcers can be recruiters, or they can even come from other roles. They can come from journalism or library science or sales, but they have to have curiosity and creativity, a technical lean or slant. They don't have to be computer wizards, just be technically comfortable with technology, right? And they have to have an intuition about time management and prioritization, because in sourcing, you have to make very rapid decisions in an ambiguous environment. In recruiting, you can't do that because you're looking for something very specific. The clients requested. So with recruiting, you're matching the opportunity with the candidate. You're looking at the fit. You're looking at the part of the process that is managing expectations. You need the business acumen. You need to partner with the hiring authority and be insightful. But in sourcing, some of those skills aren't necessary. In recruiting, for example, you have to be very systemic. You need to have a process because there's even lots of rules around it. A lot of people don't even realize that there are 7 governing bodies that have an effect over what we do. And it's not just the EEOC. There are 6 other laws that can, you know, that control our industry in various ways. So recruiting has to follow process. There's got to be an applicant flow and applicant logs and all these things. Sourcing doesn't do that. Sourcing is not systemic. Sourcing is about trying various things to see what's going to work. So that's really the difference. The curiosity to continue trying to solve that problem in different creative and tenacious ways versus the perseverance to be able to, you know, stay the course and follow through on all of the different moving parts and kind of balancing that candidate relationship, the hiring relationship. You know, Kathleen, you remember probably from way back when we first met, I was always fond of saying ours is the only industry where the product can say no.
Mm-hmm.
That's a recruiter's job, is to manage the ego of the candidate, the hiring manager, the employer. That's psychology. That's project management. But it's not sourcing. Sourcing is something else.
Well, I think it's the hardest job out there, but I think we're a rare breed. So do you have any go-to questions that sourcers must ask hiring leaders to make sure that they are going after that right person?
I'll give you two. My absolute favorite is the knockout question. I like to ask the hiring authority, what is the question that they ask every candidate pretty early in the interview process that determines whether or not this person is in or out? And they all have one. They may not realize it. They may not formalize it, but there's always a question that they ask that essentially tells them whether or not it's worth their time to pursue this. And it's a different question for each role, but there is a question. So for example, if you're looking for somebody who is a warehouse manager, facilities manager for a warehouse, I had a hiring manager once that told me the knockout question was, how many square feet was your warehouse that you managed? Because we were looking for somebody that had experience managing warehouses of up to 500,000 square feet. Most warehouse and facilities managers can't even conceptualize 500,000 feet. That's a mm-hmm. very massive facility with multiple environmental impact analyses and OSHA and all kinds of other, you know, physical layer security, power generation, and all kinds of things. The typical warehouse facility manager that's managing a 50,000 square foot building, they've only got one HVAC and a power supply that comes from the public power grid. That was a question that I would ask the candidates, how many square feet? And if they said anything above 100,000, the conversation continued. If they were below 100,000, and not if they were like 99 or 98, but if they were like 30, 40, 50,000, I would just tell them this is not going to be a fit because we need someone that actually gets this scale, this size. So that's an example. And you have to push for this because hiring managers will always tell you that they don't have one, but mm-hmm. they always do. It's the question that they ask that doesn't tell you about the qualifications, but it tells you if the person's even remotely qualified. I like to call that the knockout. That's my favorite. The second one is this. When a position comes to us for sourcing, it's almost always a very difficult, challenging position. Sometimes it's difficult for reasons that are unique. Like, you know, it's normally easy to fill in the East Coast, but when we went into Ohio, we can't find anybody. So it's difficult to fill for that reason. But a lot of times these are challenging roles. And almost every time the hiring authority tells me, we want to find the best candidates. We want to find the top candidates. We want to find top talent. So I like to ask, why is this top job? Because top talent doesn't want bottom job. Top talent wants top job. If you want me to bring you back top talent, I got to be able to tell them why this is top job. How do you answer that? Tell me that. And then I'll be able to bring you back top talent. With those two questions, I'm prepared to, at the very least, bring somebody that's minimally qualified because of the knockout, at the very minimum, right? I'm not going to bring back people that are going to get knocked out in the first 5 seconds. Mm-hmm. And with the top job question, I'm able to bring back people that are really excited about that opportunity for that reason. And they're a better match because they're self-selecting in, as opposed to someone who just wants to get a paycheck. And sure, I'll talk to the hiring manager about the job. If it's something that they get really excited about because it's the opportunity they want, then it's easier to recruit them.
Those are great questions. And I think the second one in particular is probably more important today than ever because of, you know, people needing to understand, you know, what's the story behind the opportunity and why should I really be listening to this pitch?
That's true. Yeah. In this market. Absolutely.
Are there any roles, you know, that are, you know, super, super difficult, you know, if not impossible to source candidates because of gatekeepers that you're seeing today? Because, I mean, you know, back in the day, that was one of our, you know, that was one of the things that we were really good at is really getting around the gatekeepers. But I think that's changing in some of the roles. So I'm kind of curious what you think about that.
Yeah, it's definitely changing. The role of the gatekeeper, there really isn't necessarily always a gatekeeper, more like there might be someone who is answering the phones and they're not a trained gatekeeper like it used to be. that role is sort of disappearing or it's changing to more of like someone who's a resource for a team. They might be the operations person and they answer the phone, but they're not a receptionist. They're not a professional gatekeeper. So that's definitely changed. I don't think there's any role that is impossible to get to because of gatekeepers. I think what happens is there are roles where people are not publicly visible. Mm-hmm. The position is not something. So for example, Sarbanes-Oxley auditors, you don't find a lot of them online, generally speaking, definitely not on LinkedIn, because the nature of the work that they do, they don't want you to know what they do. When they show up at your organization, they scare people because they're a pretty important part of the audit process. And they kind of don't want to, it's almost like an IRS auditor that you don't want them around, but you have to have them. And so they're not very public about that. So it's tough to get to them because they're so invisible. But there's lots of roles like that. In healthcare, it's the mammography technician or the radiology technician. They're in a lead-lined room with a machine. They're not on the phone. They're not answering calls ever. They're basically seeing patients all day and taking pictures in a secure room. Same thing with, CAT scan and others. Those people don't even have a cell phone half the time while they're at work because of the radiation or the magnetism or whatever. So there's jobs like that, in every industry. In the nuclear industry, people that work inside of the reactor. In the military contractor industry, people that work on the secured facilities, SCIFs. So there's lots of those jobs that are impossible to get to, not because of the gatekeeper, but because those people are, by design, very well hidden.
So do you have suggestions to folks that are trying to find these invisible people how to do that? Or do they just have to go the old fashioned way, pick up the phone and say, who's your mammography tech?
Well, yeah, I do have suggestions. And here's the thing. Even the most invisible thing still leaves a trace. So you have to find the footprint of the vacancy. In other words, if you look for something that isn't there, look for what's missing. Look for the gap. If someone, were walking through the snow and they were invisible, you could still see the footprints. That's a little bit too obvious of an example, but the same thing happens in these industries. There is evidence of the people that support this role and are around this role. Those are not invisible. And there's evidence that there's someone who does this job because of whatever that function is or that organization does. So you're trying to find people that have the highest level of government clearance. Well, they're going to work at a handful of organizations. So you start with a list of companies and a list of locations and a list of division names. And you go from there. So you find what's around the invisible and then hone in on that. Cynthia Hetherington, one of my friends from way back when, is a investigator who helped, was actually instrumental in catching Theodore Kaczynski. And the way that she did it was very eye-opening, and it was a very big lesson in finding the invisible. Kaczynski was invisible, but like I said, even the invisible leaves a footprint. The way that he was caught, the way that he was found, was because Cynthia found a mention somewhere of a relative of his. And spotting that relative, they went to where that relative was and were able to essentially put up a dragnet until they found that relative going to a library and pretty much followed that person back to the camp where Kaczynski was. Long story short, it was scouring through local newspapers, all these microfiche local newspapers for the hidden micro dot of an event that shows that there's somebody who's a relative of Kaczynski that was spotted or is mentioned somewhere. That was a big lesson for me. That's how you find the invisible, is by finding the trace they leave behind.
Well, I guess it really gets back to the right source or background being able to solve those puzzles. I always thought that was the fun part of what we did.
It is. If you're a private investigator and you feel like the fun part is sitting in a car, you know, waiting for somebody to do something illegal or whatever, and it takes you 50 hours of sitting in a car to do that, and you find that fun, then great. But if you don't find that fun, it could be the most tedious, mind-numbing right. job in the world. It's the yeah. same thing with us. I know people who will not tolerate sitting in front of a computer screen scouring through microfiche, but Cynthia didn't mind.
Mm-hmm. No, I hear you. So are you seeing that companies are adding internal sourcing teams to their TA groups now, or are they still, is outsourcing the way to go?
They're trying to, but they very frequently get it wrong. They will try to either create sourcers that are junior recruiters that someday want to grow up and be recruiters, and those sourcers realize that they're really good at this, and then when they're offered an opportunity to go to recruiting and it's a promotion or a raise, they'd rather go somewhere else and get a promotion and a raise and stay as a sourcer. So that ends up kind of being the end of that. Or they try to measure sourcers the same way that they measure recruiters, holding two different people accountable for the same outcome, which then pits those people against each other, and they end up with antagonistic relationships between sourcing and recruiting. Or they think sourcers are just going to download profiles from LinkedIn, or they end up doing a really good job and they essentially turn the sourcer into another recruiter, essentially eliminating the job of the sourcer. So they just end up being a job title difference. There's lots of ways that they fail because organizations do not recognize the basic value that sourcing brings, which is not a hire. Sourcing brings the value of finding the information, putting it together, and contributing to the hire, but it's not, sourcing is not directly responsible for the hire. Sourcing and recruiting working together in concert, in parallel, cooperatively, is the hire. But it's not the sourcer's responsibility. I can tell you that in many organizations, there were probably dozens, if not tens of, I would even say hundreds of hires that I influenced because I found the person, I was the first one to reach out to them, and in many cases, the only one to reach out to them, but they weren't a good fit for this job. However, they were interested in us because of our conversation, and they kept looking and found a job in our organization that they liked, and they applied and they got hired. That happened countless times, but I don't get credit as the sourcer for that hire because it's not a hire on a rec that I worked on. It's not even a hire. So, you know, if you look at it as you've got to tie the sourcer to the hire, well, you've already lost because the sourcer can add value exponentially by supporting not just hires today, but hires tomorrow. Sourcing is a discrete capital investment that has a very long return on investment. Whereas recruiting is instant on, instant off. The moment you stop paying recruiters, recruiting doesn't happen.
For people that are listening today and their organizations and they think, hey, I'm going to go ahead and outsource, find an outsourced sourcing partner. What are some of your do's and don'ts for hiring the best sourcing partner, the right sourcing partner for these organizations?
Great question. There are many cases where you should outsource. I can give you quite a few examples of when it's necessary, even if you have a sourcing team. In fact, you have customers and I have customers that have sourcing teams, right? Even they reach out to us because there's lots of reasons. There's low or no candidate flow in traditional, you know, advertising, or there's too many of the wrong applicant, or there's an excessive recruiter workload, or it's a job in a new region or a new kind of job the company's never hired for before, or there's no budget to, you know, invest in sourcing, or they don't have the ability to onboard the technology that they need. Lots of reasons, firewall limitations, cost sharing, confidentiality, strategic, all of these reasons. So one of the mistakes is expecting the sourcer to do the job of a recruiter. So going to a sourcing organization and expecting them to find the people, get them interested, and close them and bring them all the way through the process. That should be the responsibility of the recruiter, especially because the recruiter is the one that knows the organization best. And they can talk about what's exciting about the company. If the partner is responsible for all of it and you're outsourcing the entire thing, then that's a different service. That's not a sourcing service. That's a staffing agency or an RPO that's responsible for the entire process. In that case, that recruiter needs to be very well educated in the value proposition and the EVP of the company. Otherwise, if you're hiring a sourcing team to bring you the leads, the warm leads that you need, because you don't have the time, the bandwidth, the skill, the ability, the technology, whatever the reasons are, you want them to do what they do best, which is find the unfindable and get them to become interested in your company so that they can have a conversation to a recruiter. Essentially, you want them to let the recruiter get back to what they do best, not replace the recruiter when you're looking to bring in an external partner like that. The other thing I would say that's critical is, I like to call it the imperative, the sourcing imperative, is that they look beyond the obvious. So if you hire a partner and they're going to go to LinkedIn and type in a bunch of keywords and pull down a couple of resumes and do the exact same thing that basically you could do, well, don't be surprised. Let's just say don't be surprised when that job gets outsourced to an offshore team somewhere where they can do the exact same thing for $5 a day, mm-hmm. right? What's mm-hmm. important about what we are able to do, the value that we offer, is to make that connection. The connection, the logical leaps, connect the dots and find people that are truly a good match and unique and not findable. Because if you're just finding the ones that you can get with a keyword search, well, that's not special. Mm-hmm. I want you to find those people that are going to someday become a 10X. I want you to find the people before they become the VP of engineer. You want to find the ones that are the manager of engineering that's the next up and coming VP of engineering. Does that make sense?
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, with diversity being such a hot topic in today's world too, how do you source diverse candidates in, especially in underrepresented fields?
The same way you source anything else. It's really not different. What you have to do is explore other keywords, additional keywords, and other sources. But diverse candidates, for example, myself, I'm Hispanic. And when I'm looking for an opportunity, if I'm looking to switch jobs or I'm looking for a career move, I don't think, oh, I'm a Hispanic recruiter, therefore, I'm going to go to the Hispanic job board and post my Hispanic resume so I can get Hispanic jobs. I think I'm a recruiter. I'm going to put my resume where everybody else puts their resume. If you're a woman who happens to be an engineer, you don't think, oh, I'm a woman engineer, so I'm going to go to the women engineer job board to put my woman engineer resume. You see what I mean? So people that are diverse are everywhere, just like everyone. But if you want to increase the slate, the diversity slate, to encourage more options and have a more diverse options, because your hiring managers right now only have, let's just say very homogenous candidate slates, then you have to add these extra steps. That it's not doing things differently. It's using different keywords and sometimes going to different sources, but they're still the same people in the same places. You could do diversity sourcing on LinkedIn. There's a lot of different techniques that you can employ. And once again, when you can't see something, when you can't find the invisible, look for the evidence. So for example, what schools they went to. There are HBCUs and the equivalent for Hispanic institutions as well. Chances are pretty high that if someone attended one of those, then they're probably in a diverse category. You can look for the way that they refer to themselves, but they're not going to say, I am Hispanic. They might say, I'm fluent in Spanish, mm-hmm. and being fluent in Spanish is an indicator. They're not going to say, I am a female or I'm a woman, but they might use other words to describe. For example, they may volunteer at an organization that supports women, or it's not just about that. There's other ways you can do it too, but you find the footprint rather than the evidence. Don't expect candidates to self-identify. They don't really want to, unless there's a reason to specifically, they don't. And I've had a lot of conversations with people that are from different backgrounds, and there's one thing in common. They tell me they don't like being approached because they're different.
Right.
They don't like being recruited because they're Black. In mm-hmm. fact, it's offensive to them. They want to be recruited because of their skills. And what we want to do is we want to make sure that there's more representation in our slate. That's different, right? So the disadvantage is if you go out there and you expect this to be You know, we're gonna find someone that is of this particular group. Well, that actually negatively impacts other groups. If you go out there and you just look for African Americans or Black people, and then you're adversely impacting other groups. What's happening with people that have disabilities? People with disabilities, they're being ignored even more so. They were already pretty much ignored, but now you're including more, let's say, Hispanics and African Americans in your slate at the expense of even more people with disabilities. So what are you leaving behind?
So Shally, before I let you go, if a CEO is going to invest in their talent acquisition function in 2022, especially with sourcing, what would you recommend is the most important step for them to take?
The most important step would be at the highest strategic level to define what they're looking for, actually define it. Because I get a lot of requests for a candidate that is ill-defined. They say, for example, find me a 10x developer. Find me the best developers. And I ask, what does that look like? What does a best developer look like? And they can't tell me. So I can't find something that you haven't defined. I can find something that you define. But if I don't know what I'm looking for, it's very difficult to find it, right? Mm-hmm. So I think the CEO needs to look at their organization and really define what they need and what that looks like. And don't look for people who've already done it, but look for people that have the evidence of, that they show proof of having the skills that you need. Not that they've done the job, but that they have evidence of having those skills. You want someone who's a rainmaker. You don't want to hire the person who just closed the $10 billion business deal. You want to hire the person who's going to close the $10 billion business deal. How do you find them? Well, you find them because they're out there doing all the right things, making all the right moves, meeting all the right people. So you look for that footprint. So understand what it is that you want to hire. I don't mean the job description. I mean the essence of the core competencies that you want to hire. And then tell your sourcers to look for that instead of saying, here, look for these keywords. Because everybody can do that. Everybody can put a keyword into LinkedIn and hit enter.
Great advice. Well, Shally, thank you so much for spending some time with us today, and really appreciate your thoughts and counsel and advice. And I wish you all the best of luck in the new year.
Thank you. It was great speaking with you. So glad to be a guest on your podcast. Thank you.
You're very welcome. His name is Shally Steckerl, and that's it for this episode of Revolutionizing Recruitment. I hope you enjoyed the show. And if you did, make sure you take a second to subscribe so you'll automatically get my new shows when they drop. Also, if you have a minute, I'd love if you left me a review so more folks like yourself can discover the show. Until next time, take care.
This has been Revolutionizing Recruitment with Kathleen Duffy. To connect with Kathleen or to learn more about recruitment research, go to duffygroup.com.